This first poem begins with an epigraph from Christopher Smart's Jubilate Agno, which is, "For the sin against the Holy Ghost is ingratitude." And this is the Hemophiliacs Motorcycle. "May the Lord Jesus Christ bless the Hemophiliacs Motorcycle, the smell of knobby tires, Bell Ray oil mixed with gasoline, new brake and clutch cables and handlebar grips, the whole bike smothered in WD-40 to prevent rust and to make the bike shine. May he divine that the complex smell that simplified my life was performing the work of the Spirit, a window into the net of gems, linkages below and behind the given material world, my little corner of that world's danger and sweet risk, a hemophiliac dicing on motocross tracks in Pennsylvania and Ohio and West Virginia each Sunday from April through November. The raceway names to my mind then a perfect sensual music, Hidden Hills, Rocky Fork, Mount Morris, Salt Creek, and the tracks themselves part of that music, the double jumps and off-camber turns, whoop-de-doos and fifth-gear downhills, and me with my jersey proclaiming my awkward faith, powered by Christ," it said, above a silkscreen picture of a rider in a radical cross-up, the bike flying sideways off a jump like a ramp, the rider leaning his whole body into a left-hand corner. May he find his name glorified in such places and smells, and in the people, Mike Bias, Charles Godby, Tracy Woods, David and Tommy Hill, Bill Schultz, their names and faces snowing down to me now as I look upward to the past. Friends who taught me to look at the world luminously in front of my eyes, to find for myself the right rhythm of wildness and precision, when to hold back and when to let go. Each of them with a style, a thumbprint, a way of tilting the bike this way or that out of a berm shot or breaking heavily into a corner.
May he hear a listening to the sure song of his will in those years, for they flooded me with gratitude that his informing breath was breathed into me, gratitude that his silence was the silence of all things, his presence palpable everywhere in his absence, gratitude that the sun flashed on the Kanawha River, making it shimmer and wink, gratitude that the river twisted like a wrist in its socket of bottomland, its water part of our speech as my brother and I drifted in inner tubes fishing the great white carp, gratitude that plump squirrels tight-walked telephone lines and trellises of honeysuckle vines, and swallows dove and banked through the limbs of sycamore trees, word perfect and sun stunned in the middle of the afternoon, my infusion of factor 8 sucked in and my brother's dialysis sucked in and out, both of us bewildered by the body's deep swells and currents and eerie backwaters, our eyes widening at the white bursts on the mountain ash, at earthworms inching into oil rainbowed roads, gratitude that the oak tops on the hill on the high hills beyond the lawns fingered the denim sky as cicadas drilled a shrill voice into the roadside sumac and peppergrass. Gratitude that after a rain, catbirds crowded the damp air, bees spiraling from one exploding blossom to another. Gratitude that at night the star clusters were like nun buoys moored to a second sky where God made room for us all. May he adore each moment alive in the worrying world, as now sitting up in this hospital bed brings a bright gladness for the human body, membrane of web and dew, I want to hem and abide by, splendor of tissue, splendor of cartilage and bone, splendor of the tail-like spine's desire to stretch as it fills with blood after a mundane backward plunge on an ice sidewalk in Ann Arbor, splendor of fibrinogen and cryoprecipitate, loosening the blood pooled in the stiffened joints.
So I can sit up, oh, sit up in radiance, like speech after 8 weeks of silence, and listen for him in the blood rush and clairvoyance of the healing body, in the sweet impersonal luck that keeps me now from bleeding into the kidney or liver or further into the spine. Listen for him in the sound of my wife and my father weeping and rejoicing. Listen as my mother kneels down on the tiled floor like Christopher Smart, praying with strangers on a cobbled London street, kneels here in broad daylight, singing a glorious hosanna from the den. As nurses and orderlies and patients rolling their IV stands behind them like luggage, stall and stare into the room and smile finally and shuffle off, having heard God's great goodness lifted up. On my mother's tongue, each face transformed for a moment by ridicule or sympathy before disappearing into the shunt light of the hallway. Listen for him in the snap and jerk of my roommate's curtain as he draws it open, to look and look at my singing mother in her silent choir, and to wink at me with an understanding that passeth peace, this kind skeletal man suffering from end-stage heart disease who loves science fiction and okra, who on my first night here read aloud his grandson's bar mitzvah speech to me. In my half-Torah portion, the Lord takes Ezekiel to a valley full of bones. The Lord commands him to prophesy over the bones so they will become people, and solemnly recited the entire text of the candle lighting ceremony. I would like to light the first candle in memory of Grandma Ruth, for whom I was named. I would like Grandma Dot and Grandpa Dan to come up and light the second candle. I would like Aunt Mary Ann and my Albuquerque cousins, Alana and Susanna, to come up and light the third candle. His voice rising steadily through the vinegary smell and brutal hush in the room. May the Lord hear our listening, his word like matchlight cupped to a cigarette, the instant before the intake of breath, like the smoke clouds pulled in the lit tobacco, before flooding the lungs and bloodstream, filtering into pith and marrow. May he see himself again in the hemophiliac's motorcycle, on a certain Sunday in 1975, Hidden Hills Raceway, Galapagos, Ohio, a first moto hole shot and wire-to-wire win, a miraculously benign sideswipe early on in the second moto, bending the handlebars and front brake lever before the possessed rocketing up through the pack, to finish third after passing Brian Closer on his tricked-out Suzuki RM125, midair over the grandstand double jump. May his absence arrive like that again here in this hygienic room, not with the rush of a peaked power band and big air over the jumps, but with the strange intuitive calm of that race, a stillness somehow poised in the body, even as it pounded and blasted and held its line across the washboard track. May his silence plague us like that again. May he bless our listening and our homely tongues.
This poem is called Evening Song. The crickets go on with their shrill music. The sun drops down. What was it my brother said to me once in Charleston before he disappeared that spring, like the quick wake of a water mite? This was 1980, evening, the porch lights burning. He was reading from the cloud of unknowing. Robins gossiped in the poplars. Moths spiraled across the uncut grass. Moonlight wormed through the neighboring lawns. We must therefore pray, not in many words, but in a little word of one syllable. Didn't he say forgiveness was his homely double? Didn't he say what I wanted him to say? Maybe I wasn't listening, chewing a branch of sassafras, but I doubt it. As I doubt now that the life of my lawn is a still life, the moon and shrill chants, opinions on despair. There are times when the sound the world makes is a little word, something like help or yes.
This poem is written in numbered sections. It's called Hymning the Knaw. 1. Day brings a steady hand, a sure breath every other day. My brother, again on the edge of his bed, sitting up, with his eyes closed, his palms pressed, a brief prayer. You see, we're in trouble. Spring, 1972, the last flare of an April dusk. Sure breaths and relief after a run on dialysis. He's telling an old story, his slim translations of Psalms to whoever is listening. Give us strength enough. The passionate calm after a run. His pulse grows as the fresh blood thins. His drugged face opens like a fist. Runnels of spring rain, branches like floating ribs from the camphor trees. Someone is asking you to make a fist. Someone is taking your pulse and saying nothing and starting to weep over the jonquils and the yellow grass, over the cold surge of the Kanawha River.
2. Slurs on the Psalms, he calls these prayers, and writes them out in a notebook he keeps under his pillow and shows no one. Death has fallen on me like a stone I can't budge. Once death was my companion, we walked together in your house. It's an odd-numbered day, the machine like another child, bathed in a sleep. Before he sleeps tonight, my brother will forgive his body anything. Night sores, bad numbers, pain like a word. Before sleep, my brother will bless himself and lie down. The blood in a black widow falls asleep. Near an almond branch, work ants gather their meals in the noon sun. At the far edge of a field, a hospital is erected and torn down on the same day. The healers now working double time, now obsolete. Your failed kidneys swelling from pinholes to buttonholes, buttonholes to large red sacks.
3. What's in the doctor's paws and the hearts? The needle placed like a root in the red vein. The machine drones through the afternoon. My parents shuffle about him, keeping the lines clean, smoothing the blood's slow run from the body. But I am no one. I am poured out like water. Scissor clamps, the pump coils, the hours are counted out, like coins, like yesterday's good news. They pile up, just out of reach. Lord, be near. X-rays of the hip joint, fat negatives, milk light of your wronged bones. For once you can hear yourself. Syringe of sleep, syringe of another life. Close my eyes, lift these white walls. Your shadow ascends like a soul from the stretcher but holds still. In time, in good time, your own blood mutters and wakes.
Just to imagine there is something larger than me and purer. Thus my brother in a notebook, 1972. A reason to rise in the long mornings. Thus sun, moon, ghost of a chance, what the Psalms say. How long will sorrow flow through my heart like bad blood? How long will you be a stranger? Like anyone, I'm dying. He writes at his desk, sure breath after sure breath. Outside the poplars, and I'm spinning a ball through a netted hoop, over and over, getting better. Reed stem, cattail, eyelash, a leaf. A fine rain peppers the canal, a cold wind hustles the yew bushes and hollyhocks. In Tewandiwi Park, the log cabin there rests on your fingertip, twill it. Inside, your grandparents parade in your white gowns. Their eyes the color of your eyes, their wake the dust prints you'll leave behind.
5. There's a photograph, a boy on a beach, 1961. My father took it. My brother didn't know it. He sat on the hot sands, tracing his noon shadow with a Lego stick. Heat came in with the waves. He was 5. Morning opened up like a torn fingernail and began to bleed. 11 years. He sits under himself now, the flush and pull of dialysis, writing sentences. The river of God is full of water. The edge of his straw hat casts a shadow like gray fingers, water reeds. Gulls tattooed the beach. At 5, my brother saw his shadow as a circle, widening, opening. The hallway goes out like a blown candle, and you're back at your first house. Flies in the screen's light, white wings fluttering through the grilled blackness. You walk toward the coal cars by the riverbank. Damp smell of the cornfield at night. Over your head, the same stars in their ordered slide. Only this time, it's wrong. The face of the night nurse among the reeds and birch branches. The whole landscape caught like a moth in the renal room's dark.
Tonight, asleep, my brother walks out into a mild rain on the driveway. The pulse, he'll say, of drops collecting into puddles is his pulse. The soft tick against the windows, his tick, And tomorrow's an odd-numbered day, nothing but sleep and a book. A little sleep, a little folding of the hands. My father goes out to bring him back inside. He knows that he will keep this, his son asleep in his pale flesh, part of this rain in the black sky, part of these black puddles filling the potholes in the driveway, the hands ghostly, so steady. My brother is led to a dry bed and lies down, whispering after a rain, the quiet before a sleepwalker's footsteps. Your family gathering themselves forever. They play cards or read and wait for your step and your suit of scars. They stare past one another into the river and go on, waiting until your voice fills the breezes again, until the shine of the canal becomes their shine.
7. The machine drones like an old complaint. My brother's shunt, a tubed sleeve, blood vines, scaling the entire room, a red trellis of veins. I'm 11 and looking on for hours, as though over a roof's edge. The peace of a good family, like rare oil, like your name. We try to talk. Already I know the wrong words to say. I've rehearsed the gestures of my hands, how fear enters a child's voice. He's telling me that it's all right, that if the mind is lucid, it can shine like blown glass in a brilliant light. His hands shake. His drugged face blurs like a moon. You sit in a silence of rivers, the last April driftings of the canal, and watch your own ashes being raised in wind and scattered on the bank. Your family looks on without a word. In a dry cove, they've waited for your body to float by like driftwood, for your one call from the nettles, from the crickets' chirrs, from the flash of fireflies low in the grass.
When God died, my brother learned to sing. When God died, my brother slipped through the house like wind, rustling his papers and spreadsheets before leaving under a door without a sound. Lord, I look at the night sky and see your fingerprints. What are we? Almost you. There's sheep, oxen, birds. There's the sea, there's the field through which we see your vital hands. Scissor clamps, the pump, coils. The hours are counted out, but a sure breath fills the planet and another, what the Psalms say, a sure breath, a steady hand, every other day. Along the east bank of the Kanawha River, your shadow swells to its own poise and walks into the chigger bush, birds clinging like tiny scabs to the silhouette. It finds the warm grass in Tuandewi Park and lies down. It considers your guilt and lies down. It runs back to the canal and raises and slides into the black water, your body drifting across the white bedsheets, a slow erasure of your name.
Thank you. That was very nice. We practiced a lot. I'm very pleased to have introduced David Young to you. David taught for many years at Oberlin College, where he was the Walden Professor of English, and is happily retired. He's told me, I think, a half a dozen times. It's about 4 o'clock. There's no more committee work, he tells me. He still helps run the Oberlin College Press, which publishes poetry titles, and the journal Field, which he helped found in 1969, and which he also tells me is going to stop after 50 years when they hit that. I know, it's what I said. That's a few years off, right? He has published 11 books of poetry, most recently Field of Light and Shadow, selected in new poems from Knopf, 2010. He's also translated the work of Rilke, Ceylon, Petrarch, Montale, and the classical Chinese poets, and he's published books of criticism and edited several anthologies. When Tom Andrews was a senior in college at Hope College in Michigan, he spent his last semester at Oberlin as an intern for Field, and I believe that's when you all first met. So David's going to reflect a little bit on that time and just on Tom's work generally. Please welcome David Young.
Thank you, Marianne. Very nice to be here, and it's very nice to this occasion to think about Tom and talk about Tom, and you've listened to several of his poems, so you know some things about him. You know his brother died of kidney cancer, and that was a profound event in his life, and you know that he was a hemophiliac who nevertheless went in for motocross motorcycle racing. Some of these things I found out about him rather gradually, but I'll reminisce just for a moment about my first encounter with Tom. There's an organization of small colleges in the Midwest called the GLCA, the Great Lakes College Association. Oberlin is in it, and there are a number of other schools that you can think of, and named Grinnell and Hope and several other colleges. And I was at a conference of GLCA creative writing things. I think Gwendolyn Brooks was there. I think William Stafford was there. I think it was quite a nice occasion. But a young man came up to me, and he said he was interested in coming to Oberlin for a semester. The GLCA has a program in the arts which generally sends students to New York for a semester. It's a way to get out of the Midwest. You may end up just sweeping a sculptor's studio or typing a writer's poems or something like that, but it gives you a chance to be in New York for a semester. So I was just astonished when this young man came up and said he wanted to spend his GLCA semester in Oberlin. But he had a reason. He knew about Field, he knew about our magazine, and he said, I just want to be where the best magazine is put out. And this was typical of Tom. He had an instinct, I think, for what he wanted. He reached out. He was well acquainted with William Stafford at that point. He just wrote to him, and they got acquainted and became friends. And the same thing happened with Guy Davenport. He didn't pay any particular attention to status or fame or anything like that. If he liked something, he just sort of went to it. So he came for a semester, and it was a very successful semester. He was a very useful intern at the magazine. He got acquainted with the other writing students at Oberlin, and it all went very well. And then he went on to University of Virginia, where he studied with Charles Wright. We kept up with Tom. In fact, he kept up his association with our press. And as we began to expand our book series, we had just been doing translation titles, and we decided we would start to do contemporary American poets. He was part of that and had ideas about it and helped us institute our contest, which by some unlikely coincidence, Marianne Salmon won last year. Maybe Tom had something to do with that, I don't know. But he was a wonderful person because whatever he was reading, whatever he had discovered, he was happy to share with you. There was no pretension, there was no ego, really. It was just simply his happiness at being a writer among writers, having opportunities to learn more about writing. And as you heard, he had a wonderful way of putting together some fairly long and complicated poems that had autobiographical elements, surrealistic elements, things from his reading, the Christopher Smart, you know, inspiration for that first poem we heard, meant that Tom had read Jubilate Agno very carefully and very thoughtfully. And that's how he was. His reading streaks in and out of his poems constantly, and you never feel it's derivative, but you feel, oh yes, of course he would appreciate this writer or that writer. What I was thinking about today as I drove here was how good Tom got at endings. And I always think that's one sign of a really good writer. If you know how to begin a poem, that's great. If you know how to carry it forward, it's great. If you know how to end it, you're home free. I thought I'd just read a few of his endings, and then you can go find the poems and put them together with the endings. This is a poem called Paul Celan, and it ends with something that's been a kind of refrain through the poem. Are you asleep? There is no one's voice again. A poem called Postcards to Gunter Eich, a writer I think I may have introduced him to because we published his work in our field translation series. Towel and thread, cup and spoon, the names of things in a far-off book. Towel and thread. back to that in that way, I think, shows, in a sense, what Tom was teaching himself about what made a good poem. I'll skip forward a little bit. He was always expanding, I think, his own literary horizons. He invented these little movie scripts, cinema verite poems, and they're very funny and very, very different, I think, from a lot of his other work. Here's the end of a poem called Reading Frank O'Hara in the Hospital. I could be 6 years old again. Look out, Jungle Jim. Now outside I hear, quote, a bulldozer in heat, stuck in mud. And the world narrows to this window above the hospital gift shop. No, it widens. It's so hard to choose among these. Film beginning with a line by Roberto Juarez. A net of looking holds the world together. Meanwhile, the world, a little embarrassed, squirms to free itself. But the net's threads are too strong. They stretch briefly, but will not break or yield. The camera, however, cannot see itself, nor can the eye. Relentless montage of tulips, smokestacks, brooms, pickup trucks, coins, your body, dear reader, your gaze. This will not work on film. He sort of undoes what he's done. Another poem about Ceylon called A Map Is Not a Territory. This is one for many, many voices. And after he's had the voices repeating things that Ceylon might say, he says these are the description of the film. Silence, aerial shot rushing over the mountain ranges near Chemvosti, dense pine, spruce, and beech trees for miles and miles, blinding light. So just looking at Tom's endings today and thinking about them made me very happy again and realize how much I treasured his friendship. There are sometimes students who are so quick and so ready to learn that they really feel more like colleagues. And that's kind of how it was with Tom. He really didn't ever feel like my student. He felt like my friend and my colleague. And I treasured our friendship, and I miss him very much. And I'm really glad that we're all here to celebrate it. Thank you.
Normally, I don't write prose. I don't know what that thing is, prose. But I did actually write this out because thinking about Tom has been very challenging for me. And I thought I better have a little script. And you know, along the way, I learned a lot about prose writing again, which is just a ridiculous practice. I don't know why you all would do that. But anyway, I want to say, first of all, thank you so much, David, for being here. As we've had a lovely afternoon together talking about Tom and comparing some notes about him. And also, thank you to the girls who've been doing the reading. We had a very nice time, too, practicing, a very intense time. At one point, I realized they were reading very somberly because they were picking up on my anxiety a little bit. But it's been a very beautiful time as well. So, Tom Andrews was my teacher. He changed my poems and my life. In some ways, I hardly knew him, but maybe that's always the case with someone as interesting as Tom. Tom would not want me to be so serious about all this. He had a great sense of humor, of play. But he also wrote about the most serious things, things worth writing about. And he did so not only with intellectual curiosity, which he had in abundance, but also with candor, and with an eye and ear and heart attuned to the mystery, capital M. The result, poems of great beauty and uncommon insight. Tom's was a spiritual yearning for the physical world. St. Augustine and dirt bike racing. The Cloud of Unknowing and a Guinness Book of World Records record for hand clapping. Tom knew what so many of us seem to be forever learning, how and what to cherish and why. And he knew, too, this is what poetry is good for. These past few months, I've had the pleasure of being in contact with Tom's mother, Alice, and of course, we're making a video to send to Alice and to Ray, Tom's dad. She wrote me a note that is itself poetry. Alice, you should definitely write some poems, I think. And she sent along a scrapbook to Jim, and as Jim knows, I've been a little afraid of the scrapbook. I didn't want to look at it for a long time. In some ways, it's just an outline, but of course, what it outlines is a life. In it, there are announcements of awards Tom won, book reviews, mixed book reviews, newspaper clippings about Tom's hand-clapping record, a drawing Tom did as a child. It's of a person upside down with just the legs and feet showing, and it's titled, "The Man is in a Ditch." A piece Alice wrote about Tom's memorial service in New York. A letter Tom wrote to his parents to thank them for all their love and support. This is during the semester he was at Oberlin. It's the kind of letter any parent would be thrilled to receive. So you can see why for Alice to send that to us. That's a lot for her to send along to us. There's also an essay in which Tom reflects on his work. In it he says, quote, "I'm fascinated by those moments when one's vision is mysteriously enlarged, when possibilities open up into areas where before one found only a humiliating end." He goes on and responds to the common idea that writing brings order to the disorder of life. He says, "Writing helps me enter into the complexity and unpredictability of the world's presence. The effect is of being oriented, not of ordering." I like that, not order, but orientation. Not out there, but in here. And not the world, but its presence. That phrasing is a degree more palpable, I think, and more respectful too. Indeed, to be oriented is to be positioned with respect to. Again, this is the good work of poetry and of Tom's poetry in particular. For weeks, I put off writing this little talk. I couldn't get myself oriented, as it were. Couldn't find a way to read Tom's poems without ending always in tears, though I know the work very well and Tom has been gone a long time. Couldn't find the right rhythm, the way in. Couldn't find the joy in the memory. Was just at a loss. Would it help to think of it as talking to Tom? My friend Rebecca asked. I don't know, I thought, though Tom was easy to talk to. And I remember doing so in his office in Ellis Hall at Ohio University. Tom was a great listener, attentive, good-humored, kind. He wore his intelligence lightly. He made lots of things okay. And I know what he'd say about worrying what to say about him. Don't. It's not a big deal. You'll do fine. It is not an overstatement to say that without Tom, I would not be here. Tom was instrumental in the unfolding of my poems and my career as a poet and teacher. Studying with him quite literally changed my life. What I remember most about workshops with Tom was his enjoyment. He seemed excited always to introduce us to new poets and new poetics, and to discuss our work to see what was possible. He introduced me not only to the work of Charles Wright and Paul Celan, Susan Howe and Charles Bernstein, but also to my own work. He turned my attention there. He showed me how I might make my way. I think that's my definition of good teaching. And he did it in his characteristically unassuming manner, through his gentle questions and through the example of his poems. It has always seemed pretty perfect to me that I ended up here in West Virginia, his home. Before I went to OU, which is where I got my MA, I went to my local Barnes & Noble in Rochester, Michigan, and this was back when they had poetry and could alphabetize, remember that? And I remember very clearly standing there, oh, I meant to bring the book up, let me get it. This is this book, this is his first full-length book, The Brother's Country. And I remember holding this book and wondering what it all meant. both the poems, many of which looked and sounded like nothing I had ever read, and also what it would mean to study with someone who clearly knew so much about literature and philosophy, and also about life itself. It was a daunting prospect. Tom's second book, The Felix Motorcycle, was published in 1994 during my second year at OU, and I remember well the buzz that went through the workshop when we learned that what we had heard was remarkably, mystifyingly true. When he was 11, Tom really did break the Guinness Book of World Records record for continuous hand clapping. Our teacher had done that. I remember very clearly going into the workshop the evening after we all had heard that and like waiting for him to arrive. You know? Once I went to Tom's house in Lancaster, Ohio. He lived next to the fairgrounds, and there was indeed a fair going on. Those were absurd lights and noises, the carnival midway, all of it. Perfect contrast to Tom's house, which was tranquil, and his desk. You know, it's always thrilling to see the teacher's desk, whatever. To our lovely dinner. It was just the kind of counterpoint Tom appreciated. When I graduated, Tom gave me a gift I still treasure, a broadside of the poem Rebecca read, Evening Song. And it had an error in it, the cloud of uncoing, it said. Tom was amused. All his seriousness and then the banana peel that is a typo. It was fine with him. He loves things like that. Once, Tom and I and some other friends ended up at a country western bar in Charlottesville, Virginia. It was karaoke night. I still don't know what that was like. Once I called him years after OU for help with a problem, love or loneliness, some old standby, and we talked it through. Wasn't he something? That's what my friend poet Amy Newman said when I told her I was trying to write about Tom. Amy got her PhD at OU, and she was there at the same time I was, and she too has stories of Tom's intelligence and generosity and humor. Her favorite story: Tom once took an art therapy class, creating images from charcoal and crayons. He made three pieces, which she now owns. Can you imagine? The first is a series of imprints of fingerprints. He called it Ruth Buzzy Remembered. You have to be old enough to know who Ruth Buzzy is. Two blossoms he titled Smokey and the Bandit, novelization. And Amy's favorite, a stick figure, a blue wavy line and a swing line stapler, entitled Self-Portrait with Stapler and Pacific Ocean. She sent me scans of all of these. She has them in her house. When I told my friend poet Jack Riddle, Tom's first teacher at Hope College, that I was trying to write about Tom, he sent me the piece he wrote about Tom after Tom's death. This is from Jack now. He'd come into the house performing a new yo-yo trick, and while doing so, ask if I'd heard the new recording of Chopin or the one by The Clash. He could talk with you about Magic Johnson, Eric Satie, Lance Armstrong, Miro, and he could do a handstand while rolling downhill on a skateboard set on another skateboard. That's true, I've heard that from multiple people. He believed St. Augustine and the Marx Brothers were both religious figures. He had the lightest touch with the heaviest material. He could juggle. Tom was a remarkable person, a person of intellectual and spiritual depth, both of those things. A person faced with physical challenges that would waylay most of us. A person with a keen sense of humor. A kind person. Do these things account for his urgency? Do they account for his joy? He was vivid with these energies. His poems are still. My favorite poem by Tom is one that many people love, and I know that some of the girls wanted to read it, but I wouldn't let them. And David and I wrote about this to each other via email, too, about the poignancy of this poem. Like, if you want to know what poignancy is, this is what it is. This is called At Burt Lake. It's a little poem. To disappear into the right words and to be their meanings. October dusk, pink scraps of clouds, a plum-colored sky. The sycamore tree spills a few leaves. The cold focuses like a lens. Now night falls, its hair caught in the lake's eye. Such clarity of things. Already I've said too much. Lord, language must happen to you, the way this black pane of water, chipped and blistered with stars, happens to me. I noticed in listening that Evening Song, I think, also contains a line very much like, already I've said too much, or already I know the wrong things to say. Someone could write a nice academic essay about that. But maybe that's the definition of lyric poetry, right? I've already said too much. This is a poem of mystery enlarged, of possibility opening up, of great presence. Tom was not only fascinated by such moments, he also wrote them. The effect is, as he said, that of being oriented, of becoming familiar with, adjusting, and aligning to. But to what or whom? To the world's presence, Tom might say, to the mystery, to ourselves. All of these, I think, and more. The best poems resist easy paraphrase. We know this. We feel them first and repeatedly. You can write about a poem all you like. You can talk around it, but the poem remains unmoved, a little elusive, and yet right there. It means more. It won't let up. It's yours now, for keeps. Tom wrote whole books of poems like this, poem after poem, an undeniable power. I teach Tom's poems every semester. Whatever that means, to teach a poem, I do it. But with the work of a great poet, I always put the teach in quotation marks. I know who is doing the teaching. That's been Tom's work from the start.
I played hopscotch at twilight in the 20th century. The dead gave us whiplash in the 20th century. I saw the moon shipwrecked in the 20th century. I lived in a country of fireflies in the 20th century. The dead wanted us all to themselves in the 20th century.
My brother died in the 20th century. I wasted 3 years on geometry in the 20th century. I shed pints of blood in the 20th century.
The dead exhausted themselves in the 20th century. The dead echoed like hammer strokes in the 20th century. The dead drank fistfuls of rainwater in the 20th century.
I ate sweet apples in the 20th century. I ate my peck of dirt in the 20th century. I ate my words in the 20th century.
My father was 10 minutes older than the 20th century. He shoveled black coal and pitch dark in the 20th century. My brother died in the 20th century. My mother watched Gone with the Wind 32 times in the 20th century. She sold zucchini and rhubarb in the 20th century. I wrote ridiculous poems in the 20th century.
I was incapable of keeping silent in the 20th century. My marriage ended in the 20th century. My marriage ended in the 20th century.
I loved Kawasaki in the 20th century. I danced like a sumac tree in the 20th century. I prayed to the Son of Man in the 20th century.
I was anesthetized through most of the 20th century. I wrote passionate letters in the 20th century. I went to a sensitivity workshop and had my umbrella stolen in the 20th century.
The dead jiggled the change in their pockets in the 20th century. There was something very obvious in the 20th century I could never see or understand.
It was nearly possible to live in the 20th century. The dead knocked on the door of my life in the 20th century. Who's there? I said in the 20th century.
I want to remind you, of course, that we're going to have some books of Tom's for sale just as soon as I scurry back upstairs and get them. This is the last poem that appears in the collected poems. So David, does that mean we think it's the last poem that he wrote and finished?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the 20th century poem, which I always think is such an incredibly moving poem, is the second to last poem in the book. So it's a long, very long book length piece about St. Augustine and then these two final poems. Thank you so much for listening. This is called North of the Future. Did I displace you, Lord, by being here? Does my body crowd out your body? Afflict me with attention surplus disorder so I can see what is in front of my face. Sun, sparrows dart and mar each other's minor voices. The imperial river rots like a stone. Who arranged this barrage of applause and decay? Ancient of days, be with me. Wind panhandles my eyes. Black night licks at my song. The catalpa tree ponders its canny name. Lord, move just this once yourself out of the way so I can see the endless spaces you fill without you in them. Charity, mercy, hope, faith, compassion, love. A golem made of grief. I feel his greased limbs circling in my limbs, and then I don't feel him. The live world finding a choir is a soul. The soul is very small. It fits in the hand like a hazelnut. When I die, I will discover there are people in the world. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you so much. Having not had a chance to witness the rehearsals for this evening, I didn't have any idea what we were going to be privileged to experience. I mean, there was something vaguely seraphic about having Tom's words passed back and forth between.
He would love that.
It was really remarkable. And if you knew Tom, you knew how much he loved that.
Yeah.
The activity of many voices, sort of trying to articulate the singular. So thank you, David, Marianne, Christina, Hannah, Charity, Rebecca. That was really beautiful. So thanks so much. The spring before he died, Tom sent me a note in the margins of a permission slip that I had sent him. And I had sent him a permission slip asking if we could reprint some poems in an anthology that West Virginia University Press ultimately published called Backcountry. Not my title. We had a better title, but they changed it to Backcountry. And it was essentially 20th century West Virginia writers. And we had featured Tom prominently, and we needed to get permission. That class actually put this together, a bunch of students. It was a really remarkable thing, and West Virginia University Press published it. So Tom sent back the permission slip, but filling the margins was a note. And this was the spring before he died. And he was at the academy in Rome, and he just said, "I'm a prose writer, Jim. I'm just writing letters to St. Augustine." And I remember thinking, "No, you're not. Yes, you're writing those letters, but you'll never be a prose writer." In the sense that there was something so incantatory and worshipful and spiritual about everything he wrote. And what made me think of that note today is that I realized I have to go find it. In this age of emails, I get very few letters from writers anymore, but I keep every one of them, and I have for 30 years. So I have a big file upstairs in the second floor of just the letters that I've received from the writers who mattered to me. So that letter is somewhere. And the reason I have to find it is that about a month ago, I got a letter from Alice, Tom's mom, saying that she would like West Virginia University Library to house Tom's papers. And I can't tell you what a thrill that is to know and how excited we are to find out that we are going to be the home to that caretaking mission to take forward his memory and his papers and make them available to the public. And that's something that's going to be happening over the next year. So this is the first public acknowledgement of that, an announcement of that. So we're really thrilled to know that Tom Andrews' work is going to be part of our special collections from henceforth. So just wanted to let you know. Marianne and I are going to drive over there in a couple weeks and look through this thread. And I especially want to thank her for how much she's done to maintain that relationship with Tom's parents over the years. It's really been important. So she's going to run up and get that those books. Okay. I hope you'll stick around and talk to the rest of us. And thank you so much for being present here tonight in this celebration.